This is the Environment Show. It's about our stewardship of the Earth and the beauty and mystery of life in all of its forms. I'm Stephen Westcott. Coming up, researchers in the desert southwest are using satellites to track mice. The disease they carry can be fatal. It's part of a larger federal effort to monitor emerging viruses. On Alaska's Kenai Peninsula, plans are underway to protect grizzly bears. Will it work? Environmentalists in Arizona fight to keep the skies blue by slowing development. And on the Earth calendar, pirate perch are mating along the Savannah River. There are a lot of them, but scientists are just beginning to understand how they reproduce. Those stories and more coming up on The Environment Show. This is The Environment Show, and I'm Stephen Westcott, sitting in this week as host for Peter Burley, who will join us a little later in the program. In 1993, a mysterious disease surfaced in the Four Corners region of the southwestern United States. 20 people died within the first 3 months. Health officials named the unknown disease Sinombre. It's Spanish for without name. Dr. James Meegan is program officer at the National Institute of Allergies and Infectious Diseases, or NIAID, at the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, Maryland. He says it is also known as hantavirus pulmonary syndrome.
Sinombre is a virus that is carried in rodent hosts and spread to humans, usually when the humans breathe dust or dried feces or excrements from the rodents that are contaminated with the virus. They get infected by their mucous membranes as they breathe it in and contract the disease.
Sinombre is a strain of the hantaviruses. It's contracted by contact with airborne waste particles of deer mice. Hanta is short for Hantan, a region of Korea where one of the viruses was found. In an effort to better understand Sinombre and other newly appearing diseases, such as Ebola, a collaborative federal effort was initiated called the Emerging Virus Research Group. Members are in the second of the four-year project. It's funded by NIAID and NASA, the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, which is helping in part to determine where the disease-carrying mice are found.
Basically, since the early 70s, NASA has had a suite of different remote sensing satellites up, where remote sensing refers to a satellite which is making images of the Earth in various wavelengths of light. And the background in terms of what I'm applying is the translation of the reflected light from the landscape into maps of habitat parameters. And those habitat parameters will help us to understand where the deer mice exist.
That's Dr. Ken McGuire, Associate Research Professor with the Biological Sciences Center at the Desert Research Institute. The DRI lab is part of the University of Nevada system. And Dr. McGuire is a member of the Emerging Virus Research Group. Once health officials determined that deer mice were the source of Sinombre, Dr. McGuire says it became necessary to gain more knowledge about the populations, habitat, and how distribution would affect whether the virus is readily transmitted in a region.
So, for example, if I look down from space with an Earth-observing satellite and I'm able to map a distribution of vegetation in an area where there are pockets of suitable habitat that have big patches of unsuitable habitat between them, then we would expect that it would be more difficult for the hantaviruses to be propagated through the deer mice in that region. So, basically, it's an ability to measure the environment in an up-to-date sort of way that is very specific to this particular application.
Dr. McGuire says the information provided by NASA's satellite is important because maps of vegetation in the United States are either limited in scope or simply cannot be applied to the work he is doing. The satellite relays information to a U.S. Geological Survey data center, processed and eventually transferred to the DRI lab. Field work is also required, but once scientists know the location of deer mice habitats, Dr. McGuire says researchers will hopefully be able to more accurately predict where Sinombre may appear.
At a very understandable personal level, we can see how increasing density of human populations and expansion of human populations into new areas might allow for exposure to new sorts of diseases Or at a more abstract level, we might start to anticipate how changes in climate over time are going to shift the distribution of the host species and therefore expose people to diseases that didn't previously exist in their region.
While there is no cure for Sonombre, doctors are able to treat the disease with an antiviral compound. A vaccine is also currently being used for people at risk of exposure to rodent habitats. The number of reported cases of this hantavirus has dropped off dramatically in recent years in the desert southwest. But other regions of the world aren't so lucky. A hantavirus has surfaced in Chile within the last year and a half. So far, 25 cases have been confirmed there. The effort to understand Sonombre illustrates two trends in the field of biological research. The first is the use of satellites. Second is the fact that it is interdisciplinary. Again, Dr. McGuire.
We're getting to the point where we're studying systems that are so complex that it's beyond the ability of one particular background to really characterize. So in the case of this hantavirus study, we might think of there being four different levels at which you need to understand things. One is understanding the virus. Two is understanding the deer mouse. Three is understanding the habitat a deer mouse lives in. And four is understanding how that habitat is distributed throughout an area. And what we do is, in this particular team, we've brought together groups where we use the team members to make glue between these four levels.
Dr. McGuire says by taking the interdisciplinary approach, scientists are able to create a chain whereby valuable information is passed from expert to expert. The success of one link can depend on another. And accuracy is critical because this chain is part of a larger network of chains, possibly linking humans to a healthier future. Underway on the Kenai Peninsula, adjacent to Anchorage, Alaska, is a unique effort to put environmentalists, loggers, hunters, government officials, and residents together to come up with a plan which will ensure the future of the grizzly or brown bear. Peter Burley reports.
For many, the Alaska brown bear is indeed the king of the beasts.
They're very, very strong. They're very quick and fast. An adult brown bear or grizzly bear can kill a full-grown moose, so that gives you an idea of the power that they have. They truly are a magnificent animal and are really the essence of wilderness country in Alaska.
That was John Shane, Executive Director of the Alaska Office of the National Audubon Society. The problem is that bears on the Kenai are restricted by geography and pressured by increasing human presence and competition for resources. To get the planning process underway, an interagency task force of scientists has been set up to determine the condition and needs of the bear population, estimated to be between 250 and 300. Sean Farley, a research scientist with Alaska Fish and Game, heads the group, which is writing a conservation assessment.
Well, imagine, if you will, that the Kenai Peninsula is about 150 miles long, maybe close to 200 miles long and 100 miles wide, and fully about half of it is glaciers. So there's a small strip of land that the bears and the people have to coexist on. And of all the areas in Alaska, the Kenai Peninsula has experienced unparalleled growth in the last 10 years. And because it is a peninsula, there's been concern for some time among scientists with the Fish and Game and from Fish and Wildlife Service. There's been some concern that the bears, the brown bears in the Kenai Peninsula, the population may be somewhat at risk from further development.
Farley says they've put radio collars on about 40 bears in an effort to find out where they spend time and what they do. New satellite technology can give data on the whereabouts of the bear many times each day, in contrast to the old radio telemetry, which spotted the bear only a few times a month. He says some of the results are surprising.
The Kenai Peninsula is known for its salmon. It's one of the reasons it has developed so dramatically in terms of population of people is that the salmon industry for sport fishing is huge. And not surprisingly so, the bears like salmon quite a bit too. And so what we found from these collars is that the bears will spend a tremendous amount of time in highly concentrated areas on particular streams fishing for salmon. And it turns out that a bear that spends a few weeks on a salmon stream may be able to put on all the nutrient reserves, all the body fat that it needs to make it through hibernation in really only a few weeks, because it has access to this highly productive resource, which is what the salmon represents to the bears.
Farley says salmon are the only lipid-rich food source available on the Kenai. But he says increasingly, anglers are lining up elbow to elbow along the salmon streams, engaged in what has become known as combat fishing. There are so many people fishing that the bears have lost access to the streams. Another issue on the Kenai for Farley is logging roads.
Sort of the axiom within bear biologists is that logging per se, if done carefully and correctly, i.e. not a massive clear cut, may not be completely detrimental to the bear. But what is detrimental is the after effect from having the road in place. And I will certainly go on record and say that I can't think of any single logging road that really is ever taken out of commission after the fact. Especially in Alaska, it's very, very difficult and very expensive to go in and completely obliterate a road that had been there before, a road that was capable of hauling logging trucks. To be able to go in and completely remove that is prohibitively expensive, and hence it does not happen. And that logging road is still there. It's always going to be there. It's access now in the winter to people on snowmobiles. It's access during the summer. And that's what kills the bears. That access is what gets them, because people can come in and usually end up with a negative interaction with the bear.
Terry Neininger is principal and vice president of the Circle DE Pacific Corporation. His company cuts timber on the Kenai, and he has mixed views about the entire planning process.
We see that this issue is a vehicle being used by certain members of the environmental community, somewhat similar to the spotted owl issues, to stop development on the peninsula. And the bigger issue is road construction, or most of the timber sales that we now operate off of require putting our roads to bed after we complete the work. And so from that standpoint, we're not enhancing the road population, but or we're not enhancing the road situation. But further to that, we've built several miles of road over the last few years, and there's just virtually no traffic on those roads once we're done logging back in those units. We're a strong proponent on researching the status of the brown bear. We feel that we all need to accumulate some science-based data. We also feel, though, that this is a political vehicle that's being used to have a direct bearing on the harvest and natural resources on the Kenai.
Any plan to protect the Kenai bears has to be based on the condition of the population today. And while the numbers appear to be constant, Sean Farley thinks there could be disaster in the offing, because he is seeing almost no bears in the 3 to 5 year age group. He expects his study to give him more data. It is at 3 that bear cubs are abandoned by their protective mothers. They don't know their way around yet, and while they weigh 200 to 300 pounds, older bears like to eat them for lunch. They're particularly likely to look for food in dumpsters or eat roadkills along highways. Inevitably, this brings them into contact with human beings, and frequently they are killed. A draft of the first part of Farley's scientific study will be ready in the spring, and then the difficult task of getting everybody to agree on a management plan begins. It's a process which will be a first for Alaska, but parties on all sides at the moment are optimistic. I'm Peter Burley.
The Environment Show is a national production. It is made possible by the W. Walton Jones Foundation, the William Bingham Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby. www.hemmings.com. We always want to hear what you think of the show and whether you have a story idea. You can reach us by dialing 1-888-49-GREEN. That's 1-888-49-GREEN. Or by regular mail at 318 Central Avenue, Albany, New York, 12206. That's 318 Central Avenue, Albany, New York, 12206.
I'm Linda Anderson, and this is Ear to the Ground, with stories about people affecting change in the environment. This week, fighting developers in the desert. The Sonoran Desert is a type of desert most notable for the huge saguaro cactuses that grow there. Extending from the state of Sonora in Mexico to the northern boundaries of Phoenix, Arizona, the Sonoran Desert is home to vast varieties of fauna and flora that are found nowhere else in the world. However, according to the Arizona Republic newspaper, it is also a place where 1 acre of land is developed every hour. To deal with this excessive development, Sonoran North Responsible Development Advocates Incorporated was founded in the early 1990s. The goal, according to board member Christopher Estes, is to ensure the desert won't turn entirely into rooftops and roads.
The development is the largest threat to the desert here. We are running out of water, and the city of Phoenix refuses to, step up to the plate and admit it. But they're doing all sorts of things at this point to use recharged water, water that industrial areas are using, and to basically filter that water and pump it back out on golf courses to stop using the groundwater. Currently, where I'm living, we use fossilized groundwater that's been in the aquifer for, centuries. And we're pumping it out at an accelerated rate. And one of these days, it's going to be gone.
Sonoran North is headquartered just north of Phoenix, in the town of Carefree, where Estes lives. He says in a 1 square mile radius near his home, there are 8 golf courses. Golf courses, as a rule, use a lot of water, Estes says, but in the desert, it's an especially precious resource. In the Phoenix area, he says, a golf course requires 1 million gallons of water a day to replace the desert with a plush green lawn. But golf courses don't come alone. Development of homes, too, is gobbling the desert. Estes says it was the Del Webb project that really got them started. Del Webb is the developer that created the famed Sun City retirement community.
You know, they were putting homes, they were planning homes 5, 6, 7 to the acre. And, basically just coming in and just plowing down the desert, saguaros, everything, all of it, just completely annihilating it. And that project was really too far gone before we got into the process. The city officials had already been reviewing it. They had already pretty much made up their mind.
Since then, with an upswing in the economy, Estes says development is heavier than ever. The 1,000-some Sonoran North members campaign heavily to control the destruction of the Sonoran Desert. Sometimes losing, sometimes winning. They recently prevented the development of 2 new golf courses. And sometimes just struggling, as is the case with what Estes calls Sumitomo Gate.
It is a microprocessing plant that they grow the silicon wafers, and it's a Japanese-based plant. And what happened was the city of Phoenix basically entered into an agreement with the company to not to mention their name at any of the council meetings so that none of us would know, exactly who it was that was locating in our area or what it was they did. And when the nightmare was passed in September, it was the latter part of September 1995, we learned later on that this particular plant carries very high hazardous chemicals and will be admitting hazardous chemicals into the air.
Estes says a number of organizations have come together to monitor the plant and caught it several times emitting toxic fumes. A big battle is taking place in court. Development is a problem in many places, but it's the accelerated pace in Phoenix that Estes believes is so alarming. The nice weather and the beautiful desert is what brings so many people to Arizona. In fact, he says, tourism is the state's largest source of revenue. Estes complains that politicians are only shooting themselves in the foot by allowing the destruction of the desert. He says people coming to Arizona should be conscious of the fact that the desert is a diminishing resource, and the blue skies over Phoenix aren't as blue as they used to be. Literally, with all the sprawl happening, Phoenix also faces a serious air pollution problem. The day I spoke with Estes was the fourth day of a local pollution advisory. With Ear to the Ground, I'm Linda Anderson.
And now it's time for the Earth Calendar. As we speak, pirate perch are breeding in the tributaries, streams, and swamps along the Savannah River. The Savannah is more than 100 miles long and forms a border between South Carolina and Georgia. Dean Fletcher is a fish ecologist with the Savannah River Ecology Laboratory in Aiken, South Carolina. The University of Georgia operates the lab. Dean says because of the secretive nature of pirate perch, scientists are just beginning to learn about their mating habits.
Well, the pirate perch is a nocturnal fish, and during the daytime it generally stays hidden among either wood debris, aquatic vegetation, or roots underneath root banks. So during the day it's very difficult to observe. And then most of the breeding activity, feeding activity, is occurring at night, where it's also going to be very difficult to make observations on the fish. But what is currently known about the actual spawning events are that the fish sweep out small depressions thought to be probably up under the undercut banks or within the deep vegetation and deposit their eggs within these depressions. There have been observations, there have only been actually two observations of pirate perch spawning, and those have actually been aquarium spawning, so they've never been observed in the wild.
It's believed that the male parent will guard the fry after they hatch. Pirate perch reach maturity at 1 year old and live to the age of 3 or 4. The breeding season occurs between January and April, and during that time, females will lay about 100 eggs once each month. Again, Dean Fletcher.
Preparation for breeding season actually begins in June, directly following the previous year's spawning season, when the female pirate perch, throughout the summer months of June through September, just start packing away enormous amounts of fat into their body cavity. And the fat is used as stored energy for maturation of their ovary and for breeding activities throughout the late winter, early spring during the spawning season.
Dean says ovary development begins in September, and by January, the eggs are ready to be fertilized by males. Fertilization occurs at the time the eggs are laid. Pirate perch have a wide distribution in the United States and can be found from central sections of the Mississippi River to waterways along the Atlantic seaboard. They're a stout yet small fish at about 2 to 3 inches in length, but Fletcher says they can reach 5 or more inches.
In coloration, they're sort of a brownish-black color, but during spawning season, they get a rather distinct purplish iridescent cast to them. So during spawning season, they're actually a relatively attractive fish. They are anatomically unusual but not unique in having their anus in their throat region. In juvenile pirate perch, the anus is originally posteriorly located more in the normal position just in front of the anal fin, but it migrates anteriorly with growth up to right in between the gills in the adult pirate perch.
Dean says the fish feed on crayfish, grass shrimp, earthworms, and some small fish. He believes one of the most interesting behaviors of pirate perch is that they mate during some of the coldest months of the year. Maybe that's when robbers of the high seas discover the phrase, "Shiver me timbers." You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Stephen Westcott. You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Stephen Westcott. Still ahead, 300,000 acres of forest areas in the Northeast will soon be out of the hands of a large timber company and into those of an environmental organization and the public. We look at what this means for the northern forest and those who use the land. We talk green about sustainable development. It's the last in a series of discussions with Environment Show advisory board members. Can sustainable development work? Or is it a catchphrase used by optimists? And Linda Hazelstrom paints a portrait of a dairy farm where the smell of sweet hay brings back unforgettable memories. Stay with us. Conservation Fund, a national organization based in Arlington, Virginia, recently announced what it says is the largest public-private conservation deal in U.S. history. The organization plans to purchase 300,000 acres of forests from Champion International Paper in New York, Vermont, and New Hampshire for $76.2 million. Conservation Fund will first secure the deal, then 70% of the land will be resold to private companies with timber management plans, and 30% will be set aside for public use. Nancy Bell, Vermont representative for CF, describes what will happen to the timber lands in the Green Mountain State.
Of the 133,000 acres in Vermont, about 48,000 would go into public ownership in state and federal ownership, and then the remaining 85,000 acres would be private timberlands with a conservation easement, ensuring sustainable timber harvest and responsible harvest practices, as well as public access for hunting, fishing, and snowmobiling.
New York State will purchase 29,000 acres to protect river corridors, wetlands, and boreal forests, and 110,000 acres will be used privately as working forest areas that include sustainable forestry practices as well as recreation such as fishing and canoeing. A conservation plan for the 18,000 acres in New Hampshire has yet to be formulated. Andrea Colness is executive director for the Northern Forest Alliance, an organization that represents conservation, recreation, and forestry groups across New York, Vermont, New Hampshire, and Maine. Andrea describes portions of the 300,000 acres as particularly special resources.
There are a number of rivers, the Grass River and some other rivers, that there's a sort of an area of river corridors in this northwest quadrant of the Adirondack Park that are incredibly high value for recreation and fishing and ecological reasons. So it's the river corridor area of the lands in New York. And in Vermont, the heart and soul of the Northeast Kingdom is the Nulhegan River Basin. It's the ecological heart that sort of sustains the whole the whole forest and the whole Nullhegan area in the Northeast Kingdom.
The Champion sale is another in a series of sell-offs by big timber companies that have taken place this past year in the Northeast. Recently, some 2 million acres changed hands in Maine. Andrea says shifting economic trends are forcing companies to sell property. To get out of debt, she says corporations are earning quick cash in two ways.
One is, fundamentally, they are separating the forest lands that they own from the mills, and they're looking at those forest lands as independent assets that they need to essentially get as much short-term cash out of as they can. So they are both cutting those lands very hard and heavy to deliver short-term cash, and or looking to sell the lands to the highest bidder to take out their debt on the lands and pass it on to somebody else. The Champion lands present sort of a poster book kind of example of exactly this whole process.
Champion's chief executive officer, Richard Olson, is quoted as saying, "For almost 75 years, we have cared for and managed these lands in a way that has contributed to the local economy of the Northeast and protected their natural resources," end quote. But Andrea Colness has a different view of the type of steward Champion has been.
Those lands had to perform as what's called an independent profit center for the company, for Champion, which means they had to deliver return in and of themselves, independent of what the lands could actually support. As a result, the lands were overcut, severely overcut, to the point where the softwood resource, the pine trees, which are so important for a lot of Champion's mills, were cut to the point where there was there's very, very little left on those lands. As a result, Champion tried to get permission to use aerial herbicides on those lands to basically use chemicals to shorten the regrowth of a certain kind of tree, and the people of the state of Vermont said that they didn't want to allow that to happen. So Champion was forced to sell those lands.
Andrea Colness says while the 300,000 acres are fundamentally of high value, large sections have been seriously degraded. However, the forests may have a chance to grow back with time and proper management. Andrea hopes the Conservation Fund's effort will stop the cycle of heavy cutting, followed by regional economic downturns in the forest products industry because of mismanagement and changing economics. She says the conservation plan creates an opportunity where the relationship humans have had to the land can radically change. Andrea says this can occur in different ways.
One very important way it gives it to us is by simply keeping the lands undivided and undeveloped, so people can continue to have access to them for recreation and forestry uses, period. The second is by creating some very important cores of wild, unmanaged forest lands that are there for all sorts of ecological reasons, but not for timber production. But in the other opportunity that they present us, which is tremendously valuable, is that they're planning to keep large parts of this purchase in forest production, protected by very, hopefully very high-level forest management plans and easements.
The Vermont legislature has yet to approve matching funds for the deal, but if the politicians follow the hearts of many residents of the Northeast, 300,000 acres of the northern forest may have a more secure future. I'm Stephen Westcott.
We're Talking Green, and I'm Peter Burley. Today we continue our series of conversations about big issues confronting us as the century winds down, and our subject is sustainable development. Can the world economy continue to grow without depleting resources so that future generations will indeed be impoverished, or at least more than they are today? The concept of sustainable development became popular a decade ago when the Brundtland Commission said it was the key to attacking poverty and environmental problems. And some environmentalists argue that it's our only hope. Others say sustainable development in itself is an oxymoron. My guests today are two members of the Environment Show Advisory Board, Brewster Denny, Professor Emeritus of the University of Washington and former Dean of the School of Public Administration and former Chairman of the 20th Century Fund. Also with us is Paul Ehrlich. He is professor of biological sciences and Bing professor of population biology at Stanford University. He's the winner of numerous prizes for his scientific research, including the Asakawa Prize given by the United Nations, and he is author of The Population Bomb and a host of other books. Welcome to you both.
Nice to be here.
Thank you.
Brewster, let's start with you. Before we talk about whether sustainable development is possible, what is it?
Well, I guess it's the general thought is that you can grow the world and grow different economies at the same time that you don't deplete resources that defeat the end purpose. My own personal view is that a better way of looking at that issue, not that I don't think it's an important thing, is the concept of carrying capacity, of really finding out what different regions, what the great globe itself and can do. Out here, where Dr. Ehrlich and I are on this coast, we're pretty much reached the carrying capacity of the Pacific coast. There's any question about it. But nobody's talking about what those limits are or what to do, what we should do as we approach or exceed them. And that's what we need, it seems to me, if we're going to have land use and resource policies that are going to work.
I'm going to stop you for a moment. Let's defer what we do about it for a couple of minutes from now. And Paul, let me get your notion. Is this whole concept of sustainable development at all possible in your judgment?
Well, I think it was a nice catchphrase, but I agree with Brewster Denny that the idea that we can simply continue to grow everywhere the way we have been growing and it'll be sustainable is nonsensical. We're coming to the end of a period of temporary overshoot where we've been living on our capital rather than on our income, and that clearly isn't sustainable. Certainly, continued growth in the rich countries isn't sustainable. In my view, we are going to have some growth in the poor countries so we can close the rich-poor gap, but that's going to be very, very tough. So the basic answer is sustainable development is a catchphrase. I'm glad you asked Brewster to actually define it because I don't really know how.
Well, let's ask about the poor countries now since you raised the issue. How can we expect China, Brazil, Indonesia, you name it, not to do the same kind of ravaging of the environment that everybody else has as they seek to have some of the things that we've got?
Well, you raised a very good point. The answer is they're probably going to make the same mistakes we did and going to help drive the planet down the drain very rapidly.
Does that mean, Brewster, that we all have to be pessimists at this point?
Well, the only hope, of course, with respect to industrialization and growth is that it does tend to reduce population, and that would help us a lot in those parts of the world, but we're starting from a base in those other parts of the world, which is pretty dangerous. But I agree fully with what Dr. Ehrlich said about it is nonsense to talk about development as if somehow or other there was a way that all development was okay as long as you took some measures to protect it. And we just That isn't good enough.
Paul, you have spent a good deal of your life looking at the population issue. Population keeps going up. People say it may taper off. Is this the Achilles heel in the whole shooting match?
Well, yeah, because we're going to add at least, if we avoid a huge rise in death rates, which isn't clear whether we will or not because death rates are going up in many parts of the world right now, but if we avoid a huge rise, we're doomed to another 2 or 3 billion people, which is as many or more as were alive when I was born. And that means we're going to have to really pay a lot of attention to patterns of consumption. For instance, in the rich countries, we're going to have to pay, if we're going to get out of this bind, huge amount of attention to how to develop poor countries without repeating the industrialization mistakes that were made in today's rich countries. And that's going to mean a very different attitude on the part of people towards sharing, helping each other, paying attention to what is being done to the environment. And I must say that I can't be enormously optimistic about such things because I don't see these things even on the radar horizon of most decision makers today.
That really requires a whole different look at the world and everybody's place in it. We think these things are impossible, and yet I think about the fact that in this country, people did decide that smoking was a bad idea, and that took a while, but it happened. Brewster, do you see any change in thinking that can get us out of the fix that we seem to be in as a society and as a globe?
Well, the developing areas are every bit as scary as we've both said. As far as the rest of us, the so-called developed world, there are a few things that we've done. The attention to emissions, for example, that is starting to take place, is of some value. And if it's serious and we get more and more serious about it, I think that'll be valuable. I think some of us in natural resource areas have had some useful experience. I'm hoping up here in my part of the country, in the Pacific Northwest, that we will accord to the wild salmon the same sort of poster boy status that we did to the spotted owl, because the salmon is a much better talisman, sign, mark, whatever you want to call it, portent, even than the spotted owl.
They also taste better.
Yes, a lot better than they taste. A lot better than farm salmon, which are polluting the water. And I think that we have an opportunity to really do some things. The problem is getting the rest of the world to do them, and also we need to have, as a country, policies with relationship to the rest of the world that are sensible with respect to these matters. Jesse Helms doesn't help.
How do we do that? Paul, do you have some thoughts about, from a policy perspective, where we go?
I think one of the few cheery things in the picture is that a country like the United States and Western Europe and Japan have the wealth and the comfort for many of their people that allows them to look at these problems. And
yes.
So one of the clear answers is that a country like the United States has to lead the way instead of being on the wrong side. We should have a population policy in the United States, and that policy ought to be towards gradually shrinking our population by keeping our deaths plus immigrants higher than our births plus immigrants, and that's going to be a big challenge. But until we show the rest of the world that we understand that we're vastly overpopulated, we're not going to be able to offer much leadership on the population problem. Similarly with consumption. Wasteful consumption in the United States is preposterous. We're running in a country where gasoline is cheaper than bottled water, where we're building bigger and bigger cars for a country that's designed more and more around the automobile rather than around human comforts and human satisfaction. As our enormous consumption has increased, all the measures of satisfaction in the country, that is how people feel about their lives, have been going slowly downhill. And so the idea that we have to consume ever more per person to be happy is clearly nonsense, but we haven't brought these things to the political front.
And indeed, hasn't our whole income accounting system taken us in the other direction? We hear about housing starts, but we don't hear about renovation of old buildings. We hear about production numbers. Aren't we intellectually geared never to get there?
That, I'm afraid, is the problem. The cheery side is that people can change their intellectual gears very rapidly, as we, for instance, saw in the collapse of the Soviet Union and communism, as we saw in rapid changes in the United States on issues like whether women should work and whether we should show some justice towards minorities and so on.
That's
we haven't
right.
gone far enough in these areas, but we can change.
We can change. That's a very important point, and I think there's evidence in the environmental area that we can as well, but we have to get about it. We're just way too pusillanimous about it, to be frank.
Let me ask you both something about the magic of technology. There's always somebody that says, aha, there's a technological fix. The fuel cell is cleaner than the fossil fuel burning generating plant. We can always do things. There's always a gadget out there that will somehow solve the problem.
Well, I can tell you that we can't survive without a lot of technology and a lot of more efficient, fine technology. But the idea that technology is going to save us simply is a non-starter. One of the few advantages of being old is I can remember in 1968 when I wrote The Population Bomb, people said, worry about feeding 3.5 billion people? Why, by God, we can easily feed 5 or 6 billion people, no problem. We'll just do it with feeding people on algae and so on. Well,
yeah.
We've now run that course. You know, we're still not, we have now 6 billion people, and we're still not feeding something on the order of 500 million.
Exactly.
You know, so we need technology, but if you think that's a panacea, you're you're just crazy.
Second piece of that, though, and Brewster, your views on this would be interesting. Certainly, current technology is better than what used to be there. If you can bounce things off satellites rather than run copper wires all over the place, you use less resources. What should we be doing, or should the world be doing, to seeing that as developing countries develop, they develop using the best technology that's out there from an environmental perspective?
Well, certainly we have to emphasize the kinds of consumption of resources which are wrong for a long-term view of things, and obviously oil is an extraordinarily important advantage of it, and I think we can do that. I think there are technologies. We have to revise our approach to some of our older technologies. We're redesigning a river system out here, at least we ought to be, in the Pacific Northwest. If we don't, pretty soon we won't have any salmon. And we have to take a really serious look at what things we can do, and a lot of them will be technologically rather advanced things. But there are no technology fixes. At the same time, we don't want to make technology the enemy, because I think that's a popular route as well, and we want to be careful about that.
Our time is running short. Let me ask you both the James Watt question. The James Watt question being, if we're in a period of mass extinction, which E.O. Wilson argues we are, and there's not much to do about it, why bother? Why not just live it up and watch the world use up its resources and run out?
Well,
30 seconds from each of you. Paul.
Ed Wilson is exactly right. And the reason we should try and do something about it is if we wipe out many of the other species on the planet and continue to burn coal and do all the kinds of foolish things that we've been doing, our children and our grandchildren and our great-grandchildren, if they have any lives at all, are going to have lives that are very miserable. And I think most of us would like to see our children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren have better lives than we have, and that's what we've got to fight for.
Exactly right. It's a stewardship. We are stewards of this globe and of its resources and of its riches and its beauties, and it's our job now, this time, this is the key time to really carry out that stewardship and do all the things we can. Stop making so many automobiles, get the SUVs off the road, do the practical things, and get busy and be stewards of the environment.
Well, thank you both. I'm afraid our time is up. We've been talking about sustainable development. Is it possible? Where are we going? My guests have been Environment Show advisory board members, Brewster Denny, who is professor and former dean of the School of Public Administration at the University of Washington in Seattle, and Paul Ehrlich, author and Bing professor of population biology at Stanford University in California. We'd like to hear your views about sustainable development and the things we've been talking about. Give us a call. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. We've been talking green, and I'm Peter Burley.
If you can think of environmental issues that are important to you, tell us about them. Reach us via email at green@wamc.org. That's green@wamc.org. Or answer our audience questionnaire. Our website address is www.enn.com/envshow. That's www.enn.com/envshow. We all have places that are special to us. For some, it's a city street. For others, it's deep in the wilderness. For Linda Hazelstrom, it's life on the farm, among dairy cows and the smell of hay. Hazelstrom is co-editor of the book Leaning into the Wind, Women Write from the Heart of the West. In this portrait of place, Hazelstrom reads two essays. The first is titled What's in a Smell by Callie DeShaw, a writer in Montana.
Have you ever had the memory of a smell buried so deep in the well of your subconscious that its slightest essence can bring to mind vivid pictures from a chain of events years past? For me, the aroma of a bale of sweet hay brings back memories of our first snow-coated winter and a barn full of dairy cows. We all looked forward to the evening milking, for then our small world reached its zenith. Ed was home, his work in town complete for the day. Richard at 4 and Joey at 4 months each had a place in our family barn. Surcingles encircled the cows. Stainless steel buckets were attached to the waiting hooks. 4 nozzles sucked onto the tits, and the process began. While the cows were milking 2 at a time, Richard entertained his sister as she peeked, grinning from the depths of her blanketed stroller. When a bucket was lifted onto the scales, while the cow waited to be stripped, Richard ran to help his dad, to squeeze a tit, to feel that he was part of the daily process. Milk was poured, cream separated, animals fed. It was over, but not quite. We would open the double doors, emerge from the warmth of the barn into a star-studded night, clear and cold. There above us rose the beauty of snow-blazed Lolo Peak, silhouetted in all its majesty against the thick onyx sky. We would walk slowly toward the house, carrying our buckets of cream, silent in our joy. Sometimes we would stop and talk. It was then that our life seemed complete as we shared the fulfillment of these simple pleasures. 35 years have passed. The climax of my story has yet to be reached. We are the ranchers of today, but the philosophy of our life was set in a barn on Lolo Creek during a long, cold winter at the onset of our youth. Here's an additional piece that fits with this one. This one is by Anita Tanner from Cortez, Colorado, Ancestry of Cows. Lady is Sally's calf, and Skyline, Sally's mother. From there, anything, then Spot. Genealogy of cows repeated to describe a temperament as if decades on a place means identity. When Lucy kicks the hired hand across the barn, a farmer can only say, no wonder, considering her mother and her grandmother. Lucy's short for Lucifer. It's in the blood. Most people see nothing but the ground up. But old farmers can repeat a milk cow's pedigree like words to a favorite jingle. What's lacking nowadays, they say, is that kind of continuity.
That was Linda Hazelstrom reading two essays from Leaning into the Wind, Women Write from the Heart of the West. She is co-editor of the book, published by Mariner Books. Thanks for being with us on this week's Environment Show. I'm Stephen Westcott. To receive a copy of the show, call 1-800-323-9262. That's 1-800-323-9262 and ask for show number 473. The Environment Show is a national production which is solely responsible for its content. Alan Chartok is executive producer, Peter Burley is host and creative director, and Ray Graff is audio engineer. The Environment Show is made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the William Bingham Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby. www.hemmings.com. Be good to the earth and join us next week for the Environment Show.